Welcome to the Poetry Magazine podcast. I'm Lindsay Garbett, one of the magazine's co-editors. When we asked Ed Roberson who he'd like to speak with on the show, he said Lynn Hajinian. Longtime friends, despite living vastly far apart, Lynn in Berkeley and Ed in Chicago, they've been in close dialogue for almost 20 years. Lynn Hajinian is one of the founding figures of the language poetry movement of the 1970s. Her work subverts the conventions of confessional and autobiographical writing, often telling the same story multiple times in different ways. Like Ed, she often writes long poems or sequences that range widely in their references and forms. Over the past five decades, Ed Roberson's poems have been deeply attentive to how environmental injustice and social injustice intersect. He dissects city life just as expertly as the natural environment. As a longtime Chicagoan, it's been hard for me to reconcile a sense of pride in my hometown with its ongoing history of racism, violence, and corruption. Ed was born and raised in Pittsburgh, but as a resident of Chicago for over 15 years, he has captured this tension between the city's triumphs and its failures better than anyone I know. He writes beautifully of its architecture and humorously about its own self-image. As he writes in one poem in the October issue, "This town isn't big enough for the weather and a weatherman." At the same time, his work criticizes how the city's architecture, media, and laws have ignored or oppressed so many of the city's people and much of its history. Ed is widely celebrated here in Chicago, not only for his incredible work, but also for his joyful, attentive presence at poetry readings. I'm so grateful for him and his poems and this conversation you're about to hear.
Okay, I'm here.
Hey, Ed.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm okay. It's like I don't want to fall into cliches, but boy, this is a weird, awful time.
I know.
I just got an email from my brother who said he wasn't going to watch any more news, not listen to any more, after Trump said he wasn't going to allow the results of the election.
Oh, I know. It's not good. But we keep going. We're going to keep going.
Yep. No, I agree.
People will, they'll just guillotine the head off of what isn't working and grow their own head. I think that's what'll happen. I think that's what's always happened.
Yeah.
I'm not upset or depressed. You know, I'm just trying to be strong enough to be ready because it's not going to be easy.
I feel that way too. I feel the stress of it.
Yeah.
Like I'll get short-tempered and irascible and, you know, address the kitchen faucet in a way that the faucet really doesn't deserve. Yeah. And oddly, yeah. My curiosity just stays really on. Like, what's going to happen? And yeah.
Mine too. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the best thing.
You know, that makes me think. So I had occasion to go to the Wesleyan University Press because they owed me a little bit of money and would rather I got books than they pay me the money, which is fine. But so I ordered, asked what has changed.
Oh, thank you.
Which I know isn't coming out yet. But as I looked at the title, I thought, yeah, what has changed? What would Ed say? So.
Yeah. You know where that came from? A thing came in from Bloomberg, I think his name is, who did an anthology, End of the World or something. And he sent out a questionnaire to the poets. And the first question was, in the light of climate change and et cetera, what has changed? I didn't have to read the rest of the questions. It's like, oh, shit, what hasn't? You know, what hasn't changed? And so what I did was I sort of laughed at myself and laughed at him. And I started writing exactly that, that even looking out the window has changed. Whereas you used to be able to just sort of daydream out the window and have that little blank idol out the window. Now you don't know if that idol is going to last. You don't know.
Yeah.
So I started the poem, Ask What Has Changed. And the whole manuscript comes from that.
I was thinking, like, what would my answer be? And two things came immediately to mind. One is the loss of birds. It used to be in spring mornings, like at dawn, it would actually be irritating. It would be so noisy, and it's dead silent and has been for the last 7-8 years. And then the other is what's been forgotten. I mean, living on a coast.
Oh my God,
the newspaper will publish a map showing that in 10 years, this part of San Francisco and Berkeley, bay, the oceans will rise. And you see places that, that people still go to. There's little parks where you take toddlers, and they're all going to be gone.
I was trying to catch some of that sense in that book. I even had a section in there where I, you know, humans have gone through, I think, maybe 2 or 3 real tight bottlenecks for humanity. Did you ever read anything like that?
No.
Yeah, there. You know, because you get to a certain level of population where the species can or cannot live. And humans, I think, have gone through 2 of those. But something always lives after, through the bottleneck. Very altered, but something always... So there's a section in the sequence of poems where the different species show up in court and argue their case for being the head goose. In Italian suits, they come. The humans, by association, have destroyed the chances of the beautiful. Once, coats and dresses. Imagine the monsters seeing their end, seeing their grace turned upright to be filled with their hurt-aged, dredge-word new head, formerly beautiful goose. Imagine the monsters suited up and their kind of unimaginable elegance of presentation at the proposal hearings. Hearing the octopus say, "Yes, I don't live long enough to pass on what you think, your generational culture. But there are only 8 possible fundamental paradigms of mind for body. And I have all 8 on one hand. And I can square the possible. Can you tell me what more in one life of mine is there?" The octopus proposes. "What more? A mind on every sucker."
Did you see any octopi in your years of working in the aquarium that did pesky things?
Oh, yeah. I worked at what was then called the Pittsburgh Aqua Zoo. And we had a Pacific octopus from up in Alaska, you know. It was like 10 or 12 foot wide. I mean, you know, stretched out. But he would get these moods, you know. He would curl up, you know, in this little knot. He'd be in the, all the way in the back of the tank. And then for no reason or other, fly to the front of the glass. And then just swoop, spread himself 10 feet plastered on the glass. People would scream.
Do you think he was, did people think, the scientists or anybody think that he was angry?
Always thought that he was just having fun.
Yeah.
He knew how to get out of the tank. But they're unbelievably smart, and they'll get down to nothing. All they need, the only hard part, is that beak.
Right.
So they can squeeze anything that they can squeeze that beak through, they can get through.
Amazing.
So he'd go through the filtration, through the pipes, through anything.
All 10 soft feet of him.
Yeah. But that's the kind of stuff that shows you kind of where humans stand in things. You know, that there are so many other ways to take this life or life period, and there's so many different ways that things do take life. Mm-hmm. And working with animals like that, having to take care of them and feed them and friendships. Because, I mean, I trained the porpoises, so there was a real relationship to the porpoises. But with other of the animals, too, I felt a kind of link to what they needed.
Do you have anything like that relationship with language, with words? I seem to have ended up with a working friendship with a cluster of PhD classicists at UC Berkeley, and we meet once a week. I'm beginning to be able to actually recognize Greek words quite quickly. I have no grammar whatsoever, but I can say, oh. So something that really interests me, Heraclitus, part of his philosophy pivots around the question of justice.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And justice is where there's perfect balance.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that change, like the sun goes to the solstice and then to the other solstice and then back again, if it didn't do that, if it went just to one solstice, it would be cheating the other one. And the middle place is the place of justice. The word is dike. Mm-hmm. There is just thematically, as you're writing about what's happening to the climate and also what's happening to people of the non-white hegemonic power structure, especially Black and brown people. So race and environment, mm-hmm. which are really interwoven in your poems, it seems like the quest is for justice or harmony or balance.
Yes.
And that every poem is trying to assert the presence of balance and justice and harmony. Is that an accurate description?
That's exactly right. Yeah. There's even one poem where I play with the tautology, it is what it is. And it says there something about coming to balance in one spot.
Do you remember what?
Hold on a second.
It's a poem called Choke.
Is it?
I just found it.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear you read
that's,
it.
Oh, yeah, that's, yeah.
It's a long one, but it's one of my favorites.
Go ahead and read
if
that.
If you don't mind.
I'll read. Sure. Mm-hmm. It's a favorite, man. Choke. Maybe what I saw was the earth's shadow rise up a cloud, turning it toward the top pink, then fading that back to gray, then night. Then maybe I think I see too much. The tiniest gradation of detail squeezed from attention by the choke hold on thin air for the sublime, for a blessing, when life stinks and your eyes have to take it in to live. And your eyes have to take it in to live the exact instant you need to jump out of the way to safety or see danger's vulnerable spot and hit it. Your eyes have to think through what they're seeing to see how measure measures itself when you are in it against you to match or disentangle that nascent not null of difference. Maybe what I see is down to the continuum where what it is what it is, one thing, undifferentiated all, except as the surface of one perfect sphere. It's Paris and Buenos Aires, the same place. What it is what is seen without observer. It is that said, what it is, exo-existent thought, without outside. There are lines, as of poetry, of information between us, though, resonant structure. What is asleep when you turn the lawnmower on, if only the pieces we think something has caught it for? The turning of attention to, the turning of the earth. The earth is what is turning. There is no setting of the sun down. Of the sun down, some inclination to impact at our feet as fact, we stand to have written by being here. The rocks have source saying the same, except they translate silent. The word of the wind itself, spoken everywhere, has the version of it all as well, as of not happening. The sun doesn't move, its designation. What it is pushes forward the appearance, and behind the eastern shadow rising of the sun, soft down, down, it's Paris and Buenos Aires, a same place. What it is what is seen without observer. Not the thing itself, the quality of the hold on things, the choke, hold on the neck of the calling. Bird, maybe be the goddamn of Jacob's ladder. What it is could be the hands in the air, air time of the better roller coasters, pulled out all stops, the no hold barn cafe take out. Item name on the menu, the ladder being an upward, clear approach to step, the life, the breath of an answer, the questioning. I am watching the sky. Read the line below it, the landscape gets shaken by storm. Hurricane, a ring, I am married into bone dance, stone crazy. Claws of geese shatter, scratching wild song across the sky. Chicago's Potemkin waking gun we're off on. The morning, Fred Hampton, the bobbing flock of the 1919 boy in the inner tube float up on the 100th anniversary of the race riot along Lakeshore Drive. But the commuters, no idea what it is. They say it is what it is. Anger, joy, disgust, sadness, fear, all are mountains. Raising into the sky and air, a jump up shout, sound, shape, song, response, as not if, but is one body. Even among themselves at some distance, all one sphere, one point. A sense of time can be that distance is familiar, but the mind can empathize itself that size, the dreadlocks of black holes, where the anger digests itself. The joy carries its brother's sadness also over, and fear realizes it's okay, it's okay. The rains come, the forests, the jungles, the birds.
Brought tears to my eyes. That's a great poem.
Thank you.
Thanks for reading it.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's a favorite of mine too,
yeah.
Just that sense of the wholeness of it.
There's that part, the chokehold, you know, and I was thinking about George Floyd and all the others.
That's what it gets to. The very next poem begins to talk about, that poem talks about the chokehold on reality, and the second poem talks about the air. There's a poem that comes after that. It talks about having a chokehold, but not on the things that are human. Jacob, in that chokehold he has on the angel, you know, he wants an answer, he wants, you know. But sometimes some folks can get a chokehold on things that don't give that kind of answer. The hold on Floyd, that's one of those holds that I thought, that's not a hold that you're supposed to hold.
Yeah.
And there are certain holds, grips, that you need to let loose.
Yeah. You've spent some portion of your career, I mean, there was a period when you were working at the aquarium, and there was a long period when you were working as a limnologist, like doing science related to waterways. Did you feel that the kind of quest for knowledge or quest for information or even quest for data that motivates so much of science in the history of, like, since the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. is some kind of chokehold, or is it better than that?
A lot of times people just won't touch stuff. I'm saying chokehold because I think of myself as not letting go a lot of times, you know. But really, I think it's that willingness to pick up a rock or pick up anything and look at it rather than just look at it and walk by as though it isn't doing anything, you know.
I
was doing, you know, the lab assistant kind of stuff, you know, washing test tubes and taking titrations and stuff. But I was also a kid who'd never been out of Pittsburgh, you know. So it was a lot of what's this, what's that kind of thing going on, you know. That's the kind of thing that kept up, even when that kind of questioning went into words, you know, how do you put together words? A whole lot of, yeah, what's this, what's that kind of thing, you know.
There's a couple of places that reminded me a little bit of George Oppen and his almost reverence for just what is and his quest to write a poetry that simply said it is.
Yeah.
And I think that something like that or like Choke or like all of these poems in this particular group of poems of yours are, I wouldn't say exercises because they're more than that, but are manifestations of picking things up by wording them, to look at them, sniff them, see what kind of shadow they cast, put them down carefully again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
a kind of elaborate perceiving process.
That's right. That's what I'm trying to do. I know George Oppen. I was kind of shocked. You say, I like that work. And I'm happy you see that in my work, yeah.
And he, too, is a poet that was looking for balance, justice.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And also always felt ambivalent, or often, like in the long poem of Being Numerous.
Well, my favorite.
And it's like, mm-hmm. yeah, of course, it's a masterpiece. Yeah. But he's like, the world is way too complicated to come to a final position. Which I think is like, it's got so much integrity to say, I don't have the answer.
Yeah, yeah.
But here's what I've seen. And curiously, that poem ends with the word curious.
Oh, yeah.
I just remembered that. And you and I, when we first started talking today, like we both said, despite all of the terrible, catastrophic possibilities that are facing us, mm-hmm. really soon, that we remain almost naively curious.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What is going to happen? Yeah. And then what? And then what?
Because out of the curiosity, anybody might be able to offer a portion of the answer. People who pay attention, and pay attention with justice, I'm glad you brought that up too, they'll be able to give a portion of what is a possible answer. And it won't be just for that particular person. It'll be for many people, and that's what you want.
Right.
So I think the curiosity and the even-handed, just curiosity is where we should be. I don't see myself being able to survive anywhere else, you know. Because like the poem says, you have to be in a position to jump. Some people just buy their guns and put their food away, always in a position to jump, but don't pay attention to shit, you know?
Yeah.
or anybody else, and that's wrong, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I've been thinking about the cancel culture, where the sort of vigilantism that like kicks people off of, you know, out of English departments because there was one. I think somebody in the Midwest who was reading aloud a James Baldwin passage in class that uses the N-word,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and he said, I'm going to read the passage as James Baldwin wrote it. And then there was a huge outcry of rage that he used the N-word. He's a white faculty member, and he was fired.
Yeah, don't get me started on nigger, because I have a really big fight that that word is in the American English language, and there's no way you can remove that word and be honest with yourself. Now, who's allowed to use it is a whole other thing.
Right.
But that word is American, was written because of Black Americans. Black Americans have the right to use it. Folks who use it against Black Americans got to be careful about who they siding with. That's all. And all it is a matter of conscience.
Yeah.
If people don't want to think, then you remove the word. But you damn well better think. And the language belongs in a language to make you think.
Right.
To make you responsible. If Black folks don't want to use it, that's their responsibility. But you look at the 400-year history that gives them that responsibility to say, I don't want to hear this shit no more. It's their responsibility. They can say that. Okay, so the word is already in the language, is not going to disappear in the language. For one thing, I use it constantly and will continue to the day I die because I know the responsibility. I know even when I'm not allowed to use it, but I know that that word keeps me responsible and it should keep the rest of the damn country responsible since they use it so much, killed so many people because of it, wrote so many laws because of it.
Right.
How are you going to take it out of the language? Don't get me started. You know, like the song?
I think I did it.
Yeah, you did. What does the song say? Don't get me started. I tell everything I know. It's a blues song. I forget that. But yeah, you know, people need to think.
Yeah. These words register really differently in different places. And you've got to be really alert to what they're meaning.
Yeah, the responsibility for your words is the thing that, you know, how to learn to do that, how to maintain that responsibility. That's a big job.
Yeah.
You know? I just really respect people who make an effort to do that, you know.
Well, certainly that should be the job of poets, right? I mean, we're supposed to know how important every single fucking word is.
Yeah.
Yeah,
as much as we can, yeah. And there are things that we just don't know.
Yeah.
Things that we just don't know.
Well, there's not many people that we have in the years in which we've been friends and talking with each other. Like, you've said at times that our conversations are really close and even intimate and kind of uninhibited. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that would be, but I trust you. I just trust you.
Yeah.
I know that I can make a mistake, including mistakes about race issues. And then you would hear and then you would respond.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
that's true. I would. Yeah. I have, in our conversations, my side of the conversations with you, it's felt the same way, you know, that someone I could trust to understand, you know, where I was coming from and what I was trying to get at. And it's so natural. It's just no effort.
I know.
It just kind of, it's one of those friendships that just happened.
Yeah.
Thankful all these years. You know.
I love you dearly.
Coming for me, straight to you too.
I so wish we could just go to a bar now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you live two time zones away, and so we can't really meet at the corner. But maybe one more poem. I don't know which one to...
There's
For Air, which ends with champagne.
Okay, yeah, let's do that one, For Air, yes. There's a place in me for air as part of me, of a piece with how I live. And I am in it, making sense like a cart. We are each other's horse before, given, loaded with flowers. Both our breaths, a fragrance of sound, wave, and beat. Word of the heart, the music goes. Goes on to explain it is moved by the feet, taking the place apart into other places to see. Where is the surface the air impresses upon? What forms bounce into shape and form patterns of doing the way we do, that they be themselves, ourselves, scattered across the drumhead, shod with the vibration of the unsaid. Geometries of air, shod with the vibration of the unsaid, dance out their ordered sentences to freedom, the felt articulated into action, a balletic leap that seeing trails resemblances of not knowing to knowing, of silence to song, of being bound to flight, a place in the air achieved, space, not even aware the speaking might be music, or that the place of air in us might be singing. The fragrance of the flowers already worded, in stone, the airy cupolas of temples lifted off into the idea of showers of bubbled light, and the poem as the champagne of what the body has bottled in its strain.
A big thanks to Lynn Hajinian and Ed Roberson. You can read a series of new poems by Ed in the October 2020 issue of Poetry or online at poetrymagazine.org. His upcoming publications are MPH and Selected Motorcycle Poems from Verge Press and Asked What Has Changed from Wesleyan University Press, both forthcoming in 2021. Lynn Hajinian's most recent books are Tribunal from Omnidon Publishing and Positions of the Sun from Belladonna Collaborative, both published in 2019. Hajinian teaches in the English department at the University of California, Berkeley. The music in this episode came from the liberation-oriented free jazz collective Irreversible Entanglements, the band Reservoir, and Rob Mazurek. All these songs were released by the Chicago-born record label International Anthem. I'm the producer, Rachel James, and I'd love to know what you think of this new season of the Poetry Magazine podcast. Who would you like to hear from on the show? What would you like to ask them? You can get in touch a number of ways. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, which is great because it helps other people find the show. You can also email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. Until next time, be well, and thanks for listening.